Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 233, I'm joined from two colleagues from across the country and across the globe, Dr. Daniel Chow from University of California, San Diego, and Dr. Aman Chandra from the United Kingdom join me to discuss the guidelines they proposed for the use of PPE by retina specialists during retinal surgery. Dr. Chow spearheaded the guidelines released by the American Society of Retina Specialists here in the United States. Dr. Chandra was the spearheading force behind the Royal College of Ophthalmology's recommendations released in the United Kingdom. We discuss the rationale behind these recommendations and sort of the criticisms in response to these criticisms for each set of recommendations, which are very similar in terms of guidelines. None of the contributors to this podcast episode have any relevant financial disclosures. This is listed in the episode description. You can also find a link in the episode description to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim CME credits for this podcast episode and other podcast episodes. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by two retina specialists from two opposite sides of me here on the East Coast. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Aman Chandra, who is at Southend University Hospital, just outside of London in the United Kingdom of Great Britain. Aman, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for welcoming me on.
And then we're going to go travel 3,000 miles west to San Diego, sunny San Diego, where Dr. Daniel Chow is faculty at University of California, San Diego. Dan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
This may be our largest time zone spread with multiple correspondents at the same time, maybe only possible during COVID-19. And speaking of COVID-19, the reason that I have the two of you on is, Dr. Aman, you were the lead author and spearhead the group effort to publish the Royal College of Ophthalmology's recommendations, United Kingdom, for personal protective equipment, or PPE, as we'll refer to it from now on, in the setting of COVID-19 for ophthalmologists. And Dan, you filled that same role for the American Society of Retina Specialists here in the United States, based in the United States, and several other U.S. organizations, at least retina organizations, have endorsed similar guidelines. So, Aman, first, just give the listeners who don't know you a little background on your training and your background and kind of your practice in the United Kingdom.
Sure. Okay. Thanks, Jay. So I did my undergraduate training at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. And then most of my ophthalmology residency was based in and around Moorfields Eye Hospital, also in London, during which time I undertook a PhD when I investigated the genetic causes of retinal detachment. I then completed my residency and did two retinal fellowships, vitreoretinal fellowships, one in Melbourne in Australia, and my second vitreoretinal fellowship in Moorfields in London. And now I've been a retinal surgeon and retinal specialist in Southend Hospital for the last 5 years. And I'm also the research lead for the British and Irish Association of Retinal Surgeons. And I do a little bit of work as a section editor on Eye, which is our scientific journal for our Royal College. So that's a little bit about myself. I hope that's sufficient.
No, that's perfect. Now we're going to dive right into these guidelines. So just to give listener perspective, today is May 8th, and we're recording this, so things may change if you listen to this at a later date. But as of May 8th, we have these guidelines that you helped spearhead in the Royal College of Ophthalmology. So we're going to talk a little bit later about the rationale for the guidelines. But just for the listeners, sure. We're going to have a link so they can go read these guidelines. But can you just outline what sort of guidelines you put together and the timing of this? When was this proposed for PPE?
Yeah. So we proposed this for PPE wear in vitreoretinal surgery, and specifically that's what I was particularly involved in. This concept came up about 4 weeks ago, which now seems, of course, like a generation ago, because time moves so much quicker nowadays. And we were concerned by the risk to retinal surgeons. So we proposed guidelines for retinal surgeons specifically, and we recommended a few things, of course, to limit the number of surgeries that we do, to reduce the number of people in the operating theatre, to perhaps use other drapes when operating, additional drapes over the microscope, and in particular to have what we call FFP3 masks, which are almost the equivalent to your N95 masks for the surgeon and the scrub nurse, in addition to eye goggles for the surgeon during vitreoretinal surgery. I mean, this came about because we recognize that during this pandemic, retinal detachments are likely to be the most common surgical procedure that will be undertaken. And so specific guidelines for retinal surgeons need to come across and be planned. And we'll go into what, you know, how we came to this judgment probably a bit later on. But that was the summary of what we did. So surgeons need to wear goggles, FFP3 masks, which is somewhat equivalent to N95, and the nurses, scrub nurses, need to wear a FFP3 mask as well.
And so, Dan, I'll bring you in now. You actually, I think, read these guidelines, and that inspired you in a lot of ways to think of guidelines we may have here on this side of the ocean. So any major changes or additions you made in making similar guidelines as part of the ASRS committee?
Well, you know, Jay, so the short answer is no. I think our guidelines are pretty much consistent with the ones that Aman came up with. And first, I'd like to commend Aman for really having the foresight to think about these things and work together with the Royal College of Ophthalmologists to put this together. As you mentioned before, this was the first guidelines for vitreoretinal surgery. And how I got too involved in was quite, you know, serendipitous. I think I was just having the same questions myself as I was starting to perform vitreoretinal surgery right after COVID-19 began, and kind of polling people around the country to figure out, you know, what are they doing for PPE? And it turns out it was kind of all over the place. And we just really didn't know very much. And, you know, so I think we at the ASRS came together with these guidelines. And, you know, I think the only thing to add, and none of this is really specific to vitreoretinal surgery, is that, you know, at the time when we came up with these, which was probably about, it was April 20th. So I think about 2.5 weeks ago, you know, the other thing we did recommend was, if possible, to get COVID-19 testing pre-op, as close as possible to the surgery. But I think everything else was, completely consistent with the Royal College of Ophthalmologists guidelines.
So let's dive a little bit into rationale. And we're going to talk about feedback you've gotten, both positive and maybe negative, because this is an area of controversy. This is an area of developing science in terms of transmissibility. Obviously, there's a lot of fear with COVID-19. There's good information, misinformation, and there's a lot of kind of debate about the sort of things. And then there's also resources, and we'll talk about resource utilization too, which is something both of you, I'm sure, have heard about. But so, Aman, what was the rationale you built this protection on? That's the first question anyone's going to ask is, well, so why did you decide on goggles and an N95 equivalent type mask?
Yeah, I mean, so we know that ophthalmologists are probably a slightly greater risk. We work close to the nasopharynx of patients. And so that started off our anxiety. And of course, the case of Dr. Li in Hong Kong, in China, dying. The major issue with regard to the surgeries, first of all, we spend a long time not far from patients' mouths, and their breath will go upwards towards us for a period of time, be it half an hour, 45 minutes for an operation. And then further to that is the fact that the spread of the virus is through droplets or viral-laden aerosols. And aerosols are spread from breathing or coughing and sneezing. And aerosols are small molecules, which are less than 10 microns and in suspension in gas. And they travel longer distances than big droplets. And so when they travel longer distances, they are more likely to hang around, for a better word, in the atmosphere in around the patient. And they are more likely to penetrate deeper into the respiratory tract. And we know the patients with SARS tend to have low respiratory tract infections. So aerosols are probably a very significant part of the transmission. Now, here in the United Kingdom, we have guidelines with regard to PPE for various different things. And one of the aspects, a real critical point, is something called aerosol-generating procedures. So in addition to the aerosol from patients' breaths and from us to the patient, there are procedures that generate aerosols. And these are, you know, intubation, extubation, bronchoscopy, traditionally. But within those guidelines from Public Health England, they have a phrase called high-speed surgical devices. Now, FACO is, you know, it's over 40 kilohertz in frequency, and our cutters are nowadays in excess of 5,000 to 7,500 cuts per minute. And that, I think anyone would agree, would be regarded as high speed. Now, whether they generate aerosol in the same way as intubation and extubation, it's unknown and it's perhaps unlikely, but it's unknown at that stage 4 weeks ago, and certainly unclear at the moment. But we wanted to err on the side of caution and recommend that this high-speed device should be considered an aerosol-generating procedure. And in addition, we spend a lot of time not too far from patients' nasopharynx. And so this led us to suggesting that in the absence of clear evidence, that we ought to err on the side of caution, have a precautionary principle so as to act as if this is a proper aerosol-generating procedure, and that we should therefore wear masks. Now, the other aspect to it is that actually this notion of testing is a really big question. And we know that there's what's known as an asymptomatic burden. So patients who are asymptomatic can be carriers and can potentially be infectious. We haven't quantified the difference between symptomatic and asymptomatic patients. But that's why we're all in a worldwide lockdown, is because asymptomatic people can be carriers and be infectious. So we didn't want to differentiate between those who had symptoms and didn't have symptoms, and just made it a sort of much simpler and much clearer message that we ought to all wear FFP3 masks or N95 masks and goggles, because that's what Public Health England recommend that we should wear for aerosol-generating procedures. And I was quite keen, in addition, that a scrub nurse should also be protected because aerosols can travel further, and not many people often fight for the scrub nurse. So I was quite passionate for that.
That's true.
Well.
That's true. Dan, anything to add in terms of rationale? Because again, we had a huge, and I was privileged to be involved in this team. We had a huge team of doctors from across the United States kind of come together and think about this. Adding on that rationale about the aerosolization, about the possible risk with some of the procedures we do, especially the oculoplastics procedures in the orbit, anything else you'd want to add in terms of rationale?
You know, just a little bit of things. I think, first of all, I have to say, like, Aman, I think, you know, we had very similar thought process. You know, I think we may be separated by 3,000 miles, but I think there must have been some kind of telepathic link.
I think our thinking
was right on. I think first thing, you know, in terms of when we're making the assumptions of this guideline, that we really need to, you know, and think about, like, how do we maximally protect, you know, the vitreoretinal surgeon, you know, in the absence of clear data. And I think there's things that we know, things that we don't know, and things that we don't know that we don't know. And especially some
well
of
said.
These, like, critical things, like, if we don't know what's going on, you know, we should err on the side of caution. And so I completely agree with Aman. You know, I think one of the key aspects that we're still trying to figure out about the coronavirus is, you know, how it's being spread. And, you know, I think as Aman mentioned, there's kind of the aerosols, which are these small airborne droplets. And there are larger ones that are called respiratory droplets. And, you know, these have some, you know, theoretical implications in terms of the mask that you use. You know, in general, respiratory droplets should be, the surgical mask should filter those out. Whereas if they're smaller, then you worry about N95. And, you know, we have a manuscript on this. I'm sure there's also mentioned in Aman's manuscript. And, you know, there is data that the SARS virus can be detected in the air based on RT-PCR. There's also this interesting case of this chorus that was singing in Washington State, that everyone was asymptomatic, but afterwards 45 people ended up with coronavirus and two, I think, died. And, you know, there was no coughing, sneezing, et cetera. And so I think the thing is, I think it's not quite clear yet. You know, I think we don't know at this point. And just like Aman was saying, to err on the side of caution, I think we have to be cognizant of this risk. And also that vitreoretinal surgery is not a, you know, potentially low risk procedure, exactly because of the things that he had mentioned, our proximity to the nasopharynx, which we know can generate aerosol through coughing. And our long exposure. And, you know, also the fact that our drapes are not airtight. I guess the only thing that I think we also had discussion was about, you know, I think clearly, if we look at CDC guidelines, like, aerosolizing procedures are definitely high risk. And we consider things, I think, certainly intubation, certainly oculoplastics procedures, anything with a drill. You know, our, at least, and this is just kind of a minor point, I don't think it really affects, again, the guidelines, is that, you know, we thought, you know, perhaps that vitreoretinal surgery perhaps could be a relatively low-risk aerosolizing procedure because we have the closed system and the valve cannulas. But again, I don't think that really changes our management. And again, I just want to echo what Aman was saying. Like, I think I agree with, you know, testing can help. But again, as we know, there's a lot of false positives right now. We don't have a gold standard test. And so therefore, I think erring on the side of caution that we assume everyone has the virus is kind of a proper way to go. Now, of course, this is with the caveat. I think everyone understands PPE is limited and, you know, these thoughts and recommendations are not mandates and need to really be individualized for each situation.
Well said. And so let's talk a little bit about feedback. And I'm going to play the devil's advocate part for some of the feedback. I know Dan has communicated to me. And Aman, you can tell me there's some feedback on your end. I mean, I think this is the sort of thing that for the most part, many people have been very complimentary and lauded the idea of kind of getting ahead and recommending guidelines. I've heard criticisms of guidelines like these saying, you know, how can you recommend PPE and this sort of, when there's limited resources, how are you recommending this for doctors who aren't taking care of known COVID positive patients? We need to reserve that equipment for them. And I'll just insert my little thing about that. I think this is where this COVID-19 has really highlighted for us. There is a huge difference between mandates and between guidelines. And what you guys, and I assume, are saying, this is best practices in an ideal circumstance. There are going to be circumstances that we don't have adequate equipment for any reason. And that's less of an issue on May 8th, 2020 than it was on April 8th, 2020, thankfully, in most places. But we have to set guidelines for the best possible scenario to protect everyone, like you said, not just the physician, but the ancillary staff. But I have heard that criticism saying this is a dangerous line of thinking because we don't deserve, quote unquote, that equipment over people who are taking care of COVID positive patients on the front lines. And I think those ideas, I think that that's, again, going by the idea of guidelines versus mandates. We're not saying to take that equipment from somebody. We're saying this is the best practices. Aman, have you heard similar sort of feedback, if there's been any negative feedback on your end?
Gosh, almost exactly like you said. And actually, we've responded very well to it. And look, these are guidelines. And if we don't stick up for the best practice for our staff and our patients, then who will? That's my first question to that. Now, I recognize that there's a limited resource. Of course I do. And it is likely that our surgical instruments are less likely to be, you know, as aerosol generating as other things. I think that's almost certainly the case, but we haven't got evidence on that. But first of all, I'd say that our role is to discuss supply issues. Okay, that is for people in stronger positions or in higher positions, political positions, to ensure that the provisions are there for the staff that need it. We recommend that we do need it, and somebody else should make sure that it is provided for. Now, it is dwindling, and we have to accept that, and we have to probably engage with other industries to talk about how we can increase the amount of PPE that's available to everyone in the world, talk about reusing gowns perhaps and other mechanisms, and if we do go down that route, to ensure that their function remains as secure as previously. But the criticism of taking away PPE from other staff, I've heard, and I acknowledge that's an issue, but you've answered it, Jay, in the fact that these are guidelines, best practice guidelines, and a supply issue, I'd suggest, is something we should consider, but it's not our role to recommend or to answer.
Dan, anything to add?
I think that's very well put, and I completely agree with those statements. We had 15 retina specialists involved, and you can imagine how difficult it is to get 15 retina specialists degree on anything. And I think everyone that's was very funny. Careful to state, again, these are recommendations. You know, I wouldn't even say we called them, you know, guidelines, but we wanted to be very careful about our wording. Again, just like Aman was saying, you know, these are our best practices. And that given what we don't know, I think it's very reasonable, very plausible, especially when, again, our viewpoint is, you know, how do we think about what are the best practices for protecting, you know, the surgeons and staff? And then, you know, the supply issue is, I think, as Aman said, kind of a completely different issue and really up to, you know, that's really an issue of institutional leadership, which is, you know, again, not really what we're discussing and focusing on here. But I think we all agree that, you know, that there are others certainly that are at higher risk. And I don't think any of us as retina specialists would, you know, deny someone that is perhaps at higher risk compared to our procedures. But again, I think it's important to have these guidelines so that I think others who may not have thought through as much, just kind of be aware of what the general thinking should be from different retina specialists.
Well, and I think, Dan, it's funny, most of the pushback, even whether it's in this case or in other cases, like when this first started, I'll go back to March, way back when, it feels like years ago for all of us. I'll tell you, institutionally, a lot of institutions were saying, well, we don't think that everyone should be wearing a mask, even a regular surgeon's type mask. Now everyone's wearing masks to go do their grocery shopping here in the U.S. in most places. And but I think part of the reason that was driving that, most of the pushback you're getting is not from frontline providers who are saying, hey, I can't believe that the Society of Retinal Surgeons is saying this while they're, you know, doing a scant amount of retinal surgeries compared to normal, and we're here on the front lines. Most of the pushback are people in leadership positions, either administrators or people making decisions. And even, and I think giving people the benefit of the doubt, I think part of it is they feel the burden of responsibility maybe, and they feel like they don't want to be in a position where they're denying someone something that's recommended. And so counterintuitively, then you don't recommend the thing that should be recommended until you have enough of a supply. And we talked about this before. I think we were talking about in one of our COVID-19 podcasts. I talked to Dr. Steve Yeh when we were talking about Ebola and this. But I mean, this is part of the cultural thing, is we just have to be okay with saying, look, we recommend this, but we don't have enough of this right now. And I think it's uniquely a Western Hemisphere problem. If you go to countries in other continents, in Asia or in Africa, they're used to not being able to follow best practices, even for something as simple as a cataract surgery, where, you know, we here in the US, for example, we're used to switching out equipment every single surgery, having disposable instruments. That's not possible in a lot of scenarios, and people are culturally more okay with that. So I think part of it is a little bit of discomfort with the idea of we have guidelines, but for the first time in our known lives, we don't have enough of something to supply it, where having an abundance of things is usually the way the Western Hemisphere, both Europe and the US, especially the US, operate. Mm. So it's an interesting cultural reflection. I think, Dan, you're absolutely right. And Aman, you referenced this too. It's more of coming from, people don't want to feel responsible. But I think that we need to kind of change our approach to guidelines and saying, look, just because something is recommended or is the best possible thing doesn't mean it is the thing we have to do right now. Any other thoughts, Aman?
Well, you've alluded to something already. So in the UK, we have, I think it's in the region of 10,000 retinal detachments a year. So that's, let's say, 1,000 a month. Okay. The 4 week, when we put these proposals together 4 or 5 weeks ago, we just had a message from our government saying that they delivered 2 million pieces of masks to the UK that week. So if we do 1,000 detachments in the month or 2,000 in the 2 months of the pandemic, we're talking about a drop in the ocean for what the supply should be out there. So I think people need to not get ahead of themselves thinking how what we do is very little compared to what's out there. And if we use masks, we're not going to drain the supply dry, because there are many more, there should be many more masks out there, and other parts of PPE. So we shouldn't lose focus of how small our specialty, the numbers of surgeries we do compared to the amount of healthcare workers that are out there and how much amount of PPE that should be supplied.
Dan, any thoughts in addition as we start to wrap up?
Yeah, I guess just to add to that, thinking about things from institutional leadership, you know, I can understand sometimes why there might be this tension with, you know, these society recommendations. And I've even heard from some that, you know, in general, society recommendations are self-serving, in that, you know, I think they have to balance those things. But having a society put out these recommendations may give the perception or people that might make it more difficult to allocate that PPE. But again, that's a little bit off subject. The other thing I just wanted to focus on, what Aman had said, and again, this was a main motivation for me, is like, if we as individuals don't do this, no one else will. And, you know, personally for me, I was doing my second surgery. The first one, I really wasn't even thinking about PPE. But then as I was going for my second, like the day before, I was like, and as I was reading about, you know, coronavirus, I was like, well, wait a second, we are very close to the mouth. You know, patients cough and sneeze, they generalize aerosols. You know, we know our drapes are not tight. We're sitting there at much longer exposures than say other providers, and that this is all of a sudden not just a low risk procedure. And as I was getting in, you know, our institutional policy you know, didn't really say anything about N95s. And so I kind of took it upon myself, you know, after surgery to get some N95s, I think for myself, my fellow, and also I think the nurse scrub tech. And, you know, and I think kind of after that, I kind of approached my administration like, hey, I think, you know, this is an important issue to discuss. And, you know, fortunately they were very responsive, and actually the next day, then, you know, we had actually changed over those recommendations. And so now we do allocate N95 masks to doctors and patients. I mean, patients and surgeons. And so, you know, I agree. I think, you know, I think because, you know, organizations are so large, there's so many things going on that I like, as Amon said, I think, you know, if again, no one else is doing it, we need to do it. And I think it, for other retinal surgeons, if there's some issue that comes up that they feel strongly about, I think, you know, they should take action.
And it'll be easier for them to take action in their institutions if they have some guidance from their national body. And, you know, we have to be strong for our own colleagues and friends to be able to say to their institutions, hey, look, our own body recommends, has made a strong statement. Now, that institution can then ignore that statement. That's fine. But if we don't make that strong statement, well, then the institutions are potentially more able to say, well, you know, we don't have to do anything for you. And so, you know, we are supporting our colleagues by being strong, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
I completely agree.
I got to compliment, again, both of you for taking these efforts. Obviously, it was a team effort, but I think there always has to be someone to kind of lead the charge and spearhead it. And also be comfortable with criticism, as you both have come under some criticism and fire. And I think it's really important in these instances. You guys are both examples of this, that not to take anything personally. And this is for residents and fellows who are listening. If you do have an idea, you always listen to every piece of criticism you get. And you, some of it may be valid. You may have to take it in and re-change the way you think and always evaluate. But sometimes, you know, it's something to do with the heat of the moment, and you know, it's something that has to do with circumstances. And I think one of the things you guys both did is by amassing kind of a large group of retina specialists, and Dan, you did that with some of the criticism we got here, was you can kind of run that by your colleagues and kind of see, you know, is there something that you're missing, or is there some validity? Is there a different way to phrase things? And I think that helps both reassure you, but also make sure that you're not having tunnel vision, that you can kind of make sure those guidelines kind of are appropriate. So again, it takes a lot of leadership to do what you guys both did and think proactively. And now as we're starting to do more cases now, in an era where we still have COVID-19, it hasn't completely disappeared as of today, that we needed that. So Amon, Dan, any final thoughts from either of you before we break?
Things will change. So the guidelines,
yes,
will be
stay
guidelines
posted.
And I think
yes.
By the time this comes out, it may be a completely different world. You know, everything will change so quickly.
Yeah, I completely agree with Anant. You know, this is based on the best available data we have at the time. And I think there's certain gaps, I think, that we've highlighted. And I think we need people to do some more research and some more experiments to really, you know, figure out what exactly is the risk for these vitreoretinal surgeries, how good are our, you know, protective interventions. And of course, that's going to inform us and constantly evolve our guidelines and recommendations.
Amon Chandra, Daniel Chow, thank you so much for all you've done. And thanks for joining the podcast. And who knows, maybe in another month, like you said, Amon, we'll be back here and we'll be going over some new guidelines that are different. And this will feel like something that was years ago when we recorded this. But thank you both. Both of you stay safe as we start to pick up clinically. And thanks for your time.
Jane, Dan, great to meet you. Stay safe.
See you soon,
yeah,
hopefully in person. Take care, guys.
Yeah. Take care. Bye-bye, then.
As always, you can find this podcast episode and all other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 233 episodes can be found there sorted by category. You can subscribe to the latest episodes on our website or by subscribing in the podcast store app on your Apple or Android device. You can reach out to us at retinapodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at retinapodcast, or by clicking the contact us link on our website, retinapodcast.com. Thank you for all the ideas and thank you for reaching out with suggestions on things we can talk about. Remember, we recorded this episode on May 8th, 2020, so apologies if any of this is dated at the time that you're listening to this. This will be released on May 11th, 2020. Many thanks to Dr. Chandra and Dr. Chow for their time and for their efforts in putting together these guidelines as part of the large team of people and all the people who participate in putting these guidelines together, both in the United Kingdom and here in the United States.
Thank you to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, Dr. Mike Venicasa for their efforts putting together this episode and the accompanying social media. And thank you, podcast listeners, for what you're doing as we reopen, as we start to return hopefully to more normalcy, a new normal maybe here in the United States. Thank you for what you are doing for your patients and continue to publish, write, and innovate so that we have things to discuss here. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.